signals so that I can somehow, my brain comes up and says, oh, there's Mr. Dunbar sitting there. How does that happen? How can that make us see things? And the fact that I remember that it's Mr. Dunbar. Oh, yeah, I remember Mr. Dunbar. He wasn't here last week because he's been sick. You know, how does that happen? And yet, there's certain things we don't remember. What's going on in our brain that we remember certain things, we don't remember other things? And most troubling, sometimes we remember things that are not. And that's kind of the scary part. That's part of my question here. Can you trust your memory? Now, so that's what's going on up there, and nobody knows exactly what's happening. But one thing that they have figured out is that at least we can determine when activity is taking place in different parts of the brain. And there are three ways that they measure brain activity. And I'll just briefly mention these here. One is functional magnetic resonance imaging, an fMRI. Now, basically, they're able to detect a signal when the oxygen level in a neuron changes. That's pretty fantastic. They can do that. But they can detect a signal. It's called the blood oxygen level dependent signal, abbreviated BOLD. And they can pick up those signals from neurons. And the ones that are extracting the most energy are the most active. You know, like everything else, start running, you use more oxygen. Well, the brain, when it starts humming, starts using more oxygen. Of course, we're talking about extremely small changes. But anyway, they're able to see that certain parts of the brains are more active than others through fMRIs. Another way is positron emission tomography, PET scan, which uses trace amounts of a short-lived radioactive material to map out the functional parts of the brain. And the higher the area of radioactivity, the more active the brain, that part of the brain is. So they use that. And then the one that you see most often, and the one that's the most fun to pronounce, is the electroencephalography. Let's call it EEG. And this is one where they put all these electrodes all over your scalp. And these little electrodes, because that neuron fires an electrical charge down the axon, they can detect that. And they can detect groups of them, basically. And so they detect this electrical activity, and they can zero in then on where the brain is most active. And so we have these, and there's some other ways too, but these are the most common, and particularly the EEG is used quite a bit to determine. So what scientists have figured out is that we know which part of your brain is working under certain circumstances. Now, they break the brain up into a bunch of pieces for discussion purposes, like the frontal lobe, the parietal lobe, so forth, temporal lobe. You know, these are general areas of the brain. And then through these tests, you know, they'll ask a person or show a person a picture that's funny, and with it, when they're all wired up, a certain part of the brain lights up. Then they'll show them a picture of something that's sad, another part of the brain lights up. You know, show them something that's scary, a different part of the brain. So they start identifying, okay, here's an area that's associated with fear. Here's one associated with happiness. Here's one associated with sadness. Here's an area that's associated with analytical, doing numbers and so forth. And they figured out all these kind of things. I don't know whether you can see this. Probably can't see that too well from here. But it's showing some of these general areas, but they've broken it down, and they're showing things like where areas for sensory perception are centered and different things. And so they kind of mapped out the brain without worrying about the details there. They've kind of mapped out the brain. And they at least know when you're afraid, what parts of the brain seem to be most active. But what they've also found out, that even though activity may be centered in a certain area of the brain, it's kind of it kind of spreads out into other parts of the brain. It's not just a single activity, but it's concentrated there. It's kind of like dropping a rock in a pond and the ripples that go out. It's kind of like that with the brain. You create an activity in a part of the brain, and it just kind of filters through and spreads out. But it's centered in different areas for different kinds of things. For example, the hippocampus is located there, kind of in the center of the brain. And that's the area that they believe is the focal area for memories. Now, if you don't have a hippocampus, you don't have memories, is basically what they've discovered. Now, see, and this is all theory, really. They don't have absolute proof of some of these things, but what the current thinking is that when neurons are frequently excited as a group, that they start recruiting, and they recruit additional receptors, creating new and stronger synapses. On the other hand, if they're not active, then it goes the other way. And so they think this is kind of how memories grow stronger, or you forget. Depends on how often and how much these additional synapses are created. So there's a lot going on in your brain. I mean, it's not just there, but it's creating synapses, disassociating synapses, and just a lot going on. And that's about all we know, that there's a lot going on. Now, they have come to understand that there are two types of memory. Procedural memory. Procedural memory is how we do things without really thinking. That cup of coffee, the snack you had before services that you were sipping away on, you didn't think about that. Unless somebody knocked your elbow and you almost spilled it. Then all of a sudden you begin actually thinking about the fact that you have a cup of coffee in your hand. But otherwise, it's just there. Your arm is taking care of business and so forth. And as far as your conversation with someone, you might as well not have had an arm as far as you realizing it's even there at any particular moment. You know, it's kind of like, they say you... Once you learn to ride a bicycle, you never forget. Why? Or throwing a ball. You never forget. You know, I had an interesting experience with I've talked about him before, an Egyptian friend of mine, colleague there in the faculty. He grew up in a soccer world. And he never played a sport that required swinging a stick. Never played a sport that required swinging a stick. Now, I just say, just about anybody here, you know, I put a stick in your hand and say, swing that for me, you'd have a decent swing. Well, he decided, I'd been playing golf, and he decided he was wanted to take up golf. He said, okay, we'll go out in the driving range, and I'll show you how to hit a golf ball. I failed. I could not show him how to hit it. He had never swung a stick. You know, your assumption is, you go out there, you know how to swing. It's just a matter of the proper grip, and to get your feet in the right position, and you got to turn your body a certain way, and you got to keep that lead arm straight. You know, there's all these kind of details. He didn't need the details. He simply needed to learn, how do you swing a stick to hit something? After one session, I give up. he was that time, he was probably in his 60s, and said, "That's too late. I'll never learn golf." But to learn requires some analytical thinking. But after a while, something happens, and you don't have to think about it anymore. You just go out, you stand over the golf, and you swing, and you hit it. You don't think much about it. Matter of fact, if you start thinking about it too much, you probably hit it worse than just letting that intuitive system take over. You know, so we're talking about that, and it's associated with an outer section of a part of the brain called the stratum. which is also associated with generating habits, which is interesting. That's here. I'll show you the stratum. That's where the stratum is, kind of on both sides of the hippocampus, who is embedded in there. But that's procedural memory. And, that works pretty good. But how in the world do we remember all that? Nobody knows how the brain exactly works all that out. But it does. But then there's the other kind of memory, the episodic memory. And it's kind of remembering events in your life, autobiographical kind of things. Past experience, feelings, places, ideas, all these kinds of things that you can think back and remember. Now, we all have all of our memories going back to, I think my earliest memories go back to about 5 or 6 years old. I don't think I can remember anything. I don't remember much, but I can remember a few things back that far. How do I do that? Now, how come I can't remember it all? How come, what's going on here with our minds? And as I said, this is stored in the hippocampus. That's the center for episodic memory. And now, it's associated with non-habit behavior. Now, here's the one interesting thing that scientists believe, is that depending on the activity, it's not just the hippocampus that fires up, but other sections of the brain might. For example, the amygdala will fire up also if it's an emotional thing, a memory that brings emotions into play. The hippocampus, and there's the amygdala down there at the bottom, if you can see that. It fires up also. And, of course, if it's a memory that is fearful, another part of the brain fires. So all this stuff is all interconnected, intertwined, and blows my mind. So we have these two types of memories. the episodic memory and the procedural memory. Now, it's our episodic memory that is kind of important to us when we begin looking at our lives, looking at what we've done in the past year, that sort of thing. The procedural memory, do I still know how to ride a bike or something like that? That's not so important until you get on a bike with your grandkids and decide, do I still know how to ride this thing? But let's look at something here. Where does Sabbath keeping fall in terms of procedural memory and episodic memory? Where does it fall? You ever thought about that? Well, let's look at the Sabbath commandment in Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11. It's fairly long as the commandments go. But it begins with an interesting word, remember. Remember the Sabbath day, and remember why? To keep it holy. Now, that's how it starts out. Remember. And I got to thinking about what do you do during the Sabbath? I got to thinking, what do I do during the Sabbath? Sabbath evening, I'm usually doing a fair amount of Bible study, because if I don't have a sermon that week, I know I've got a sermon coming up, and so I'm usually doing research for future sermons, sometimes just personal things that I get interested in. There's my episodic memory, in place, because I'm going back and looking at scriptures and so forth. But then go to bed that night, usually sleep a little later the next morning. It is a day of rest. So I get up a little later. Then there's the morning routine of eating breakfast and getting a shower and getting ready to go to church. And we have to leave around 11:15 or so to get over here to church. So the morning's pretty shot in kind of procedural things. Just doing the routine things I do every Sabbath morning to get ready to go to church. Then I'm here at church, and now my analytical brain's kicking back in, and we talk and discuss and we remember things and that sort of thing. And then Sabbath service is over, and we hang around some more, and then go home. By the time I get home, kind of tired, it's getting late in the day. Yeah, I kind of say, okay, now it's the time to just rest for a little while. And the Sabbath's gone. And so you get wonder, well, how much of the time did I really keep it holy? And how much was just a habit, procedure? It makes you think what you're doing in the Sabbath. Now, let's continue reading here. 6 days shall you labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work. You, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gate. Which reminds me, I got a call from an elder friend of mine from years back. It's been a long time ago now. He dialed me by mistake. He thought he was dialing somebody else in his phone book, and he hit me. But anyway, he knew who it was. We got to talking because we hadn't seen each other in a year or so. And so we got talking. He had given a sermon recently about the Sabbath, one of the examples he used in the Sabbath. And he was a little upset about this. One of the examples he used was that he had a farm, and there was somebody came in to bale hay or do something like that. And it was on a Friday. And the guy messed around and didn't finish. And it came up to sunset. And he said, that's okay, go ahead and finish. And he used this as an example when he gave a sermon on the Sabbath later. And at that church at that time, they had a committee of members who reviewed a sermon and decided whether to put it on the local website. And they rejected his sermon because of that example. And he was a little upset about that. And he'd gotten to a habit, don't worry about things like that. But this phrase in here, nor the stranger who is within your gates. How often do we think about something like that? Yeah, he didn't think about that. He just said, I hate to ask the guy to come back later on. He's only going to be finished another hour or two. Yeah, but so we fall into this kind of procedural memory instead of analytical memory. I think that's what happened to him in this case. But it requires our episodic memory to truly keep the Sabbath holy. Now, I've been asking this question, how do you remember? And we really don't know. Science doesn't know how we remember. But they kind of know a little bit about what the process is. The current thinking is that current theory is that memory formation is dynamic, it's an evolving process that changes throughout our lives, lasts throughout our lives. It's a live thing, is what they've come to determine. When these neurons are frequently excited as a group, with the additional receptors recruited, it creates new and stronger synapses, which creates stronger memories. And if that doesn't happen, the synapses kind of separate and the memories fade, that sort of thing. And as we accumulate these new experiences and reflect on the past, the strength continues to grow or is blunted. And the longer the interval from the event, the more distorted a memory can become, which is interesting, and I'm going to talk some more about that in a minute, but the whole idea here is that, we cannot always trust our memories because they can become distorted. Now, I've been showing you pictures of the brain. Here's another one. But here's what scientists have found. About the only thing they can really do is they can measure when parts of the brain fire up, when they start working, sending out those electrical signals. That's about the only thing that science can really do is see where it was firing up. And so what they found is that initially the fired up area is in the hippocampus. But as time goes by, when you reflect on a particular memory, initially it's in the hippocampus fire cell, but as the years go by, that area of the brain is not so active when that memory is revived, but another part of the brain called the medial prefrontal cortex. And this, the prefrontal cortex is this general area up here. The medial prefrontal cortex is right in there. And old memories fire up there instead of in the hippocampus. So there's a gradual shift in what areas of the brain are associated with a given memory. And an interesting thing about the medial prefrontal cortex is it's also associated with self-centered thinking. It's kind of the me area of the brain. And that's where those memories drift to. And here's what they found. They give a test, they have people wired up to see what parts of the brain are firing up. And they'll ask them a question like this. Does stubborn describe you? Okay, now when that happens, it's the medial prefrontal cortex that fires up. Because it's a me thing. You start, your memory is saying, well, am I stubborn? And that part fires up. But if the question is, does stubborn describe Brian? the medial prefrontal cortex does not fire. See, there's a me area and there's a non-me area. Well, which is kind of interesting. And so it raises another question, is how self-centered is your memory? How self-centered is your memory? You ever think about your memory being self-centered? Well, long-term memory is centered in that part of the brain that is a self-centered part of the brain, which is interesting. And what they've determined through interesting tests, and I don't have time to describe them here, but with time, your memories will tend to focus more on yourself and less on other details. And they do tests where they'll ask people about great catastrophic events and so forth and find that how the memories change over the years. But I want to just show you one example of that. It will go back to Genesis 40, chapters 40 and 41, actually going back to early in that 30, the story of Joseph. That's what we're talking about here, the story of Joseph. So I'm just going to talk about a little bit of it here, but you remember the story. Joseph ends up in Egypt. He is working for this Egyptian whose wife makes a pass at him. He rejects her. She has a fit. He ends up in a prison. And while he's in prison, Pharaoh gets mad at his baker and his butler. And they're in prison, so they get to know each other, and then the baker and the butler have these dreams. You know, and the butler dreams that this vine with three branches and grapes grow, and he's crushing grapes into a glass to give to the Pharaoh. And Joseph, through God's inspiration, interprets the dream. Says, in 3 days, you're going to be restored to the Pharaoh's house, and you'll be serving him again. And then the baker also gets excited because he had this dream of these three baskets on his head and the birds coming and eating the stuff out of the baskets. His news wasn't as good. In 3 days, he was going to die. He was going to be killed there in the prison. And that both of those things happened. But in verse 14 here, Joseph said, "But remember me to the butler who's leaving, being restored." He said, "Remember me when it is well with you, and please, I didn't spell that right, show kindness to me, make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house." Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Now, there's a classic example of the me. Now, you know, I asked you this question. You know, is your memory self-centered? Let's take the example of the focus of your prayers, just as an example. What do you do when you pray? What things do you pray about? Well, one of the things you pray about is things in your own life that aren't going well. and you probably pretty vividly remember those things. And you're pretty consistent with praying about things that you need help on. But how about praying for others? You know, we take this congregation by itself. There's a number of people here that have serious health problems, life or death type of health problems. Is your memory focused on your own problems and not so much on the brethren around you here and their health problems? You know, that's going, you know, how self-centered is your memory? Certainly you should be praying about your own problems. But are you like the butler who kind of forgets and every now and then, oh yeah, almost forgot, God, be sure and intervene and heal all the sick people in the congregation. Now, if that's the extent of your prayers for the brethren, you need to sit and have a conversation with Mr. Sandilands about your prayer life. It needs to be more depth to it than that. You know, so how self-centered is your memory, and how is it reflected in your life, not just prayer, but in other things, in helping others, giving to others, and things like that. Now, finishing up with the story of Joseph here, we jump over to chapter 41. I'm just going to read two verses here, because after two full years, in verse 1 of Genesis 41, then it came to pass at the end of two full years that the Pharaoh had a dream. And you know about the dream of fat cows and skinny cows and the 7 years of good harvest and the 7 years of bad harvest. You know, the whole story there. But then in verse 9, then the chief butler spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I remember my faults this day. He realized he had been asked to remember Joseph to Pharaoh, and he had failed. 2 years go by, whoops, I remember. Now, of course, would this have a little bit to do with getting more in Pharaoh's favor? Oh, yeah, I know the man that can interpret this. And so, you know, so we can get very self-centered through convenient memories, memories that are important to us. You know, what's going on in that picture of the brain in the medial prefrontal cortex where it's about me? A lot of memories in there. And we've got to kick in our analytical system to make sure that we are not too focused on ourselves. You know, people will very easily recall things that are consistent with their own self-perception and let memories fade that don't coincide with their own self-perception. You know, you tend to forget about the things that shows you're bad because your self-perception is, hey, I'm pretty good. But then the things that are good, oh, yeah, boy, man, I'll never forget that. I hope that poor woman across the street, that old lady across the street. I'll never forget that. But you don't even remember the time you almost ran down an old lady driving down the street. You know, and so our memory is can be very self-centered. Now, again, I'm going to turn to this one rather than reading. 2 Peter 2, 3 and verses 1 through 7. 2 Peter 3, verses 1 to 7. Get over to it here. I went to 1 Peter 3, which says, wives, be submissive to your husband. Never helps hurts to remind wives of that, but let's go to the proper scripture in 2 Peter 3. Verse 1, beloved, I write you this second epistle, in both of which I stir up your pure minds by way of reminders. So he's saying, I want you to remember some things here. that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets and of the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior, knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lust, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. For they willfully forget that by the word of God, the heavens were of old, the earth standing out of the water and in the water, by which the world that then existed perished before the flood waters. But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. You know, so he's saying, you've got convenient memories. You know, that's the message there. You've got convenient memories. There's another scripture. I'm not going to turn to this one. I'm going to skip this one. Romans 11, 16 through 24 talks about grafting on to the roots and so forth, talking about Gentiles and so forth. And again, it talks about kind of the same thing. You kind of get these convenient memories. But let's go on to a little bit more about the research here. Research shows that memories for negative feeling fades more quickly than for happy ones. That's kind of similar to what I was talking about a minute ago. I think the classic example of this is found in Numbers 11, verse 5. We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt. You know, this is where they're out in the wilderness. They've got the manna. Should be pretty happy about this stage. And they start complaining and they say, we remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up. There is nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. They wanted some meat. That kind of makes me confident that I'm an ancestor of these people. Because I, too, am a meat and potatoes man. I want to eat that meat. These are definitely my ancestors. Talk to you. But, yeah, the incredible thing about this is they had just come out of abject slavery and misery and moaning and groaning and looking to get out of that condition. And they're out for a few weeks or a month or so. And what do they do? What do they remember? Do they remember how bad it was as slaves? That's kind of like, it almost sounds like Louisiana cooking here, doesn't it? I wish I was in Louisiana again. You know, that's what they remembered. And all the other things were gone. Now, the intuitive system, it takes an egocentric, a self-centered approach, and it's biased. That habit type of thing is very biased. Matter of fact, it's so biased that when parts of the story are missing due to the confusing nature of the experience, the intuitive system tries to fill in the holes. There's this interesting study that was done where these psychologists got together with the parents of a grown child and talked about, tell us some stories about things that happened to them when they were 5, 6 years old, back in their fairly early childhood. And so they picked 4 stories and then talked to the grown child about them. The trick was that one of the stories was made up. The other 3 were true. But they discussed each of these, say, well, here's what your parents told me, that this happened. The one that wasn't true, well, you got lost in a mall when you were 6 years old and wandered around and so forth. The subject remembered it. And as they discussed it and so forth, he started elaborating on, oh, yeah, I remember. I think I was in front of a Macy's maybe. And it didn't happen. And that's the intuitive system. Well, my parents said it happened, it must have happened, and start filling in blanks. And that's kind of scary that our minds work that way. We do have false memories, and so we have to really be sharp, you might say. Keep that analytical mind focused and questioning, is that really a true memory? Am I remembering correctly? You know, that's our challenge. Keep the memories, the meaning of the days of unleavened bread in our analytical system. Not let it drop off into our intuitive system. Ecclesiastes 11:8. Truly the light is sweet and it is pleasant for the eyes to behold the sun. But if a man lives many years and rejoices in all of them, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Don't forget the bad things. Now, I want to ask you a question here. In all the Bible, what are we most often told to remember? All the Bible, taken as a whole, what does God most often tell us to remember? You ever thought about that? If we're going to remember one thing, if that's all we're going to remember, what is it that God tells us to remember the most? Well, I submit to you that it's what he first told the children of Israel back in Exodus, like in Exodus 13:3. And Moses said to the people, remember this day which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by the strength of the hand of the Lord, by the strength of the hand, the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. I submit to you that remembering the Exodus is said more in the Bible than anything else. Now, what I did when I started thinking about this, I'll look. And so I did remember. And then I did forget, looking through the concordance, I looked at forget, like don't forget. And then I looked at the word Egypt and so forth. And so I found there was, there's quite a few scriptures there. Quite a few. I'll just list them for you here. Deuteronomy. There they are. I don't know how many that is, 8 or 10. In Deuteronomy. Don't bother to copy them because there's a lot more. I don't have time to wait for you to copy them. Joshua, there are a couple in Joshua. Judges, 3 or 4 in Judges. 2 Samuel, there's 4. 1 Kings, a couple. 2 Kings, 3 more. 1 Chronicles, there's a passage. 2 Chronicles. Nehemiah, several there. A bunch in Psalms, a bunch in Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Amos, Micah, Haggai, Malachi. Whew. How about the New Testament? Acts. Boy, there's a long one in Acts, Acts 7, Stephen's inspired sermon, 17 through 43 in Acts 7. Hebrews, a bunch in Hebrews. Jude. All those reminders to remember the Exodus when God took our ancestors out of Egypt. Over and over and over again. God thinks that's really important. You know, all our feast days, most of them only have this one day feast. The days of unleavened bread are 7. Why is that? Can we just do it all in one day? It'd be a lot easier if we only put the leavening out for one day. Why do it for 7? Could it be that God really wanted to remind us and us to remember the Exodus, what happened to those people, and learn that lesson for ourselves? It's like he said, okay, here's the way I'll make sure you remember it. First of all, I'll just splatter the scriptures with reminders to remember it. That's the first thing I'll do. But that's probably not enough, because there are a lot of people who just don't remember things. So what I'm going to do, instead of making it one day, it's going to be 7 days. And no bread. Well, bread, but not bread, you know. No real bread for 7 days. Now, that doesn't get them. Well, I'm going to give up on them. That's just it. There's no hope. Yeah, so we have this 7-day holy day to focus on the Israelites coming out of Egypt, coming out of slavery, coming out of sin, and the New Testament analogy of you and I in slavery to the world and coming out. He wants us to never forget that. So he threw in 7 days. The only other time we have more than a 1-day feast is when? Feast of Tabernacles. And what are we celebrating there? Being in the kingdom of God, being spirit beings. So God, it's almost like God saying, okay, this is pretty great. You're going to be in God's kingdom. You're going to be helping me in the world tomorrow. That's worth 7 days. But so is this. Remembering coming out of Egypt and the lessons learned. We don't know how our memory works. And we can't always trust our memory. But God will help us remember if we put in the effort through His Spirit. So remember that God brought the children of Israel out of Egypt.